So you're out on a date with a really hot girl that you're interested in, and she starts acting out. She's had maybe a few margaritas. She's, you know, in the upper atmosphere because you're in Colorado. You're going to a Beetlejuice show, and she just starts making a scene, taking pictures, yelling things at the stage, you know, just generally kind of acting out a little bit. How do you respond to that?
I am a public decorum guy. I mean, if it's a Rocky Horror,
loser.
If it's Rocky Horror Picture at Midnight, or if it's a, you know, a concert where singing along, throwing
well,
up
Rocky
a lighter,
Horror.
Or
wait. Rocky Horror is sacred. You can't, you know, you can't screw around with Rocky Horror. So
it's 100% crowd participation though at Rocky Horror show. So
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I don't know what the vibe is at a Beetlejuice show.
I would assume that it is white trash Rocky Horror, whereas Rocky Horror is like theater kid.
Goth is, you know? Goth Beetlejuice. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I was with Kevin Williamson hardcore when he infamously smashed that woman's cell phone at a showing of the great, like, not, it's like the Deep Impact Armageddon, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson to Hamilton. They both came out around the same time, and this was years back in New York for the listener who
well, that's completely different though. That's a completely different vibe. Like,
it's a musical. It's a period
piece.
No. Two bloodies in the title.
If you act out at, you know, some kind of opera or any kind of real, you know, classical music scenario, I think you should be thrown out on your ear and banned from the theater. But Beetlejuice. Like, I mean, come on. Like, you know, this is Michael Keaton can't take, you know, or the Michael Keaton substitute can't take
the
someone
non-union
yelling
equivalent.
at the theater.
Well, so then that raises a question. What is the cutoff? Like, you know, the Mendoza line in baseball, right? Like, you have to hit over, you know, 200 to be, you know, to be a real major leaguer. What is the cutoff show? What's the cutoff musical? What is the shittiest musical best musical you can sing along to and interrupt?
Wicked or it's Waitress.
It's the Wicked line. You call it the Wicked line.
The
you
Wicked
can,
line.
You can act out at Wicked.
Look, I think that to answer your earlier question, you know, that woman didn't go far enough. I mean, we've all seen Tombstone where, you know, people shooting at the stage. I mean, you know, there was a missed opportunity there, you know, to, you know, sort of go full Wild West. But in actuality, I would probably excuse myself to go get a drink, air quotes, and then just completely ghost the whole scene.
Seriously, you would abandon the woman? That's
terrible. I would absolutely Irish goodbye that.
No. You have to. Oh, come on, man. No, this is hoes before bros, man. Like you have to stay with the woman even as she gets increasingly crazy.
I mean, are we talking first date, or are we talking this is a known quantity?
This is a known quantity. They've been dating for at least like 2 months.
Yeah, and you can assume under those conditions that there are other redeeming qualities about that person.
Obviously, given that she was spinning around underneath his arm as they were exiting the theater. I mean, if that is not sort of an indication of intimacy, she is just sort of saying, thank you so much for standing with me during this situation where I yelled at a bunch of fat people trying to kick me out of a theater.
Well, it's different if you are with your significant other and they have made a decision that the people in this theater need to pay for some real or imagined wrong, or that they need to act out for whatever reason, then you stand by your woman, of course. But if that's like first date or third date behavior, I'm probably with John. I'm probably looking for a easy out.
When I look at this scenario, this article on Politico's front page denouncing Lauren Boebert for her despicable display at the sacredest of things, you know, a depiction of Beetlejuice in musical form at a Denver theater, was literally lined up across from an article saying that everything that this Virginia House of Delegates candidate did, where she took money to have sex with men other than her husband, who were also married, was fine. And that we were being prudes if we were conservatives or Republicans or what have you, or independent voters, or, you know, whatever you want to ascribe it to. You are a prude if you judge that as being a bad thing in terms of wanting that from a representative politician. So the fact that those two things, like, they literally were on the same level, or on the same level of Politico, this front page thing. And I look at one of those things and I'm like, okay, is Lauren Boebert behaving like a, you know, silly sorority girl from the University of Colorado? Absolutely. Okay. But one of these things is not like the other. Okay. One of these things just isn't the same.
Well, sure, but I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure. Yet that's a false choice, brother. I mean, I think you could say they're on like they're on wildly different levels. But it, you know,
I don't know. I'm just saying if Gretchen Whitmer had done this exact same thing,
oh, they would have yas queened her. They would have yas queened her until they were blue in the face.
Yas queening her
absolutely
so much she would be on every nightly show saying, go watch Beetlejuice. It's awesome. I love Beetlejuice. You know, that kind of thing. By the way, Beetlejuice, pretty good movie.
So one other piece of context on this that I have not seen yet is, what time was this show? Are we talking like a late night thing, or is there like a matinee with kids?
It's
there?
Definitely. I mean, it's completely dark when they get out of the theater. If you have not seen the footage, I strongly encourage you to see the footage.
It's like the Zapruder film at this point. We're analyzing.
It's fantastic. there are multiple angles. It's great. It's not just like some grainy thing. It's fantastic. Whoever cut
if
that
I can,
together.
If I can try and bring just a little bit of substance to this conversation, I would say that you're absolutely right that there is, we were talking about this in a different context, the three of us, that there absolutely is a thing where behavior, especially when you're talking about women, where in politics, where behavior that would be yas queened on one side is just absolutely ground into the dust if it's a Republican woman doing it, because there's a kind of sublimation going on among kind of, you know, reconstructed male feminist ally leftists who aren't allowed to say the thing, or, you know, or criticize women on the left. So they really enjoy like suspiciously much. There is this double standard where female Republicans, especially of a certain kind, which is kind of what you're alluding to, are safe outlets for misogyny on the professional left. And it's this kind of, yeah, it's this kind of channeling of unacceptable behavior into acceptable targets. And that's why you see the kind of outsized criticism of these people that you do, and when they're Republicans, because they can't say the thing that they want to say about the people on their own side.
This is Thunderdome, and we have plenty to talk about this week.
It's too bad this episode will never air.
The impeachment inquiry has advanced regarding Joe Biden, and Kevin McCarthy is getting a lot of flack for it from Matt Gaetz and from some other people. The situation there is obviously one that is going to put this presidency in a different context. You know, they're going to have the ability to call and subpoena a lot of different folks, and they're going to get more access to evidence. James Comer has already said he believes that they can tie at least $10 million from foreign entities to the president of the United States. Does this matter, John?
It all depends on if they can prove it beyond the shadow of a doubt, then it absolutely matters. But I think that this is a real high wire act for Republicans, in that I think negative partisanship being what it is, I think that this is going to lead to a circling of the wagons around President Biden. Somebody that, again, for younger, more progressive Democrats, he may not be their cup of tea. There might be, you know, I think there is, you know, evidence that there's real decreased enthusiasm for him in some quarters of the party. But as we've seen time and again in the last 10 years or so, anything that turns politics into a shirts on skins game rallies those people right back, the same way that every time that Donald Trump would be under a new indictment, you'd see his numbers spike. Now, I don't think that Biden has the same ability to convert that or to monetize that or to drive publicity out of it the way that Trump does. But I think you'll have a rally around the flag. That said, if the Republicans are able to show beyond the shadow of a doubt and in a way that is understandable, I mean, if we end up with a flow chart that's got 400 arrows and shell corporations and you kind of have to
squint. Charlie Day situation.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, something that is just so convoluted to a degree. I mean, I think it's kind of what happened, you know, no matter where you sit with the Russiagate stuff or the FBI investigation thereof, where, you know, it was hard to explain in a minute and my own attention span would kind of fade at that point. If it's a straight line, then yeah, it's incredibly damning. And I think it would be impeachable.
Let me just interject here and say, John, I think you're you know, operating on a very reasonable opinion. In fact, it is held by one of my colleagues at Fox News. Laura Ingraham said essentially the same thing to me just last night when I was on air with her. And I grant that there's a lot of basis for that. But impeachment is a political act. It is a political decision. And whether or not you have some kind of quote unquote smoking gun, I would argue that actually historically impeachment does not require a smoking gun. Simply offering the tools of the vice president's office to Hunter Biden in the way that we've already proven that it exists, meaning like sharing schedules, calling in, meeting with the people that he wanted him to meet with. That to me is sufficient to accomplish a bribery, and I would vote to impeach based on that if I was in the Congress. But you know, different people have different thresholds. Obviously, the first impeachment in American history was over the fact that the guy was drunk. So you know, it doesn't require you to have this kind of illegal activity. You know, Dan, do you think that this is going to be something that could blow up in the Republicans' faces? Just to continue the Laura Ingraham reference, she said to me, you know, I'm worried that this is Lucy in the football and that Republicans are Charlie Brown.
Well, so, I mean, you're of course right about the way that impeachment has worked in the past, but I think the dynamics that John is talking about, the shirts for skins dynamics, have kind of broken impeachment as an institution the way that they've broken so many other checks and balances that we had in our system. You know, it's been remarked before that the one thing the founders really didn't anticipate was not just factionalism, but how powerful the parties would be at totally scrambling like prerogatives, for instance, between the branches of government. And so impeachment's a perfect example there, where it's like the fact that, you know, the president and a majority, you know, a thin majority, certainly a veto-sized minority in the Senate have the same letter at the end of their name, means that whatever the, you know, yes, impeachment's a political act, and yes, doesn't need to be illegal, but it means, you know, even if you know, Biden, you know, drove a car off Chappaquiddick Bridge with a young staffer in it and left her to drown, I don't think he would be convicted in the U.S. Senate. What I do think, you know, so the question is, does it matter? Does it matter in terms of, is there a chance he's going to get convicted? No. Is it possible that it could hurt him or wound him badly enough that it'll be the, you know, straw that broke the camel's back in terms of whether he'll be the nominee? I think mm-hmm. that's possible. I think it's more possible now than I've, like, you know, suggested over the last 6 or 7 weeks on this very podcast. I do feel like I've got to change my kind of Bayesian probabilities a little bit about how likely I think this stuff is. And one thing, and one reason, which is also just the hilarious irony of the situation, that kind of cuts against John's, you know, thread on a pin board argument, is that this is part of this is about Burisma, right? So part of this is about the thing that Trump got impeached for. And I was watching Hunt for Red October last night, and it's like that scene where Stellan Skarsgård is, you know, the Russian captain on the Alpha, and he takes the safeties off his torpedoes, tries to
kill us.
Sean Connery, you arrogant ass, you've killed us. So the torpedo comes back and blows him up. The hilarious irony here is you know, you kind of have to wonder if Biden was, you know, doing one of those side-eye memes, one of those Arthur, you know, memes when Burisma was spinning up, and kind of, you know, laughing nervously and thinking, well, maybe don't push too hard on this one, because part of this is about all of that stuff. And, you know, the American people do have a shorthand for that. We were subjected to the entire Trump impeachment. And so they will know what that is. And they'll certainly understand things like, you know, bribing Chinese officials and, you know, all of that stuff. So I do think there's a chance that it could matter. And it's also worth just saying, though, this is following a classic line between like corruption on in the Democrats and corruption under the Trump Republican Party, which is basically that the Democrats are more genteel and more like buttoned up in how they do their corruption. It's like the difference between the Clinton Global Initiative, by which, you know, Bill and Hillary Clinton like live the lives of billionaires, but they do it in a very buttoned up way where they use the right shibboleths and everything's got a prospectus and a PowerPoint slide. And the Trumps are just like, we'd like to do corruption, please. You know, they just, it's the same thing. It's with, you know, with better decoration. And I think that's kind of what you're going to see with the tale of these two impeachments, is you're going to see that, you know, Biden and his army of lawyers and advisors took at least basic precautions to cover their asses in this situation. But even still, I mean, we've got the phony email address, you know, we've got this network and web of payments. I think
more than 20 LLCs, more than $20 million transferred. I mean, it's a lot. You know.
It's dirty. Yeah, it's totally dirty. I do think, and I'll shut up, but I do think it's a little bit premature on the House GOP side. I think they needed to push the investigation itself a little bit further, and so that it at least looks on the surface like, oh, well, we're left with no choice but to move to the impeachment phase here because we've really got this damning case. So I think it's a little premature, but we've talked before on this podcast about how their calendar is short and compressed because of the election. So politically, this was probably the time to do it.
Yeah. So a couple of things. Wait, John, just to interject. Is there a woman in America whose favorite movie is The Hunt for Red October? I'm going to say no.
I think that's it. Maybe you got Connery and a young Alec Baldwin.
Our own future U.S. Senator, Fred Thompson. Too.
Sweaty men in dark mood lighting. You know, I don't know. I could make the case.
David Ignatius writes this article in the Washington Post, saying that Biden should step aside. We all know David Ignatius. I've had the luxury of interviewing him many times. He is obviously one of the most connected people in Washington. He is considered Biden's favorite columnist by a number of people. I don't know whether that's true or not. He is someone very well connected within the world of the CIA, the FBI, etc. Key figure within the Russiagate kind of side of things, but also a brilliant guy and someone who's a very good writer, which you can't say of a lot of people at the Washington Post these days. He writes, Biden would carry two big liabilities into a 2024 campaign. He would be 82 when he began a second term. According to a recent AP poll, 77% of the public, including 69% of Democrats, think he's too old to be effective for four more years. Biden's age isn't just a Fox News trope. It's been the subject of dinner table conversations across America this summer. Because of their concerns about Biden's age, voters would sensibly focus on his presumptive running mate, Harris. She's less popular than Biden, with a 39.5% approval rating, according to 538. Harris has many laudable qualities, but the simple fact is she has failed to gain traction in the country or even within her own party. Ignatius goes on to urge Biden to step aside, that essentially he needs to withdraw from the 24 race because if he runs again, he risks allowing the return of Trump. In other words, Ignatius is taking the exact opposite argument of a lot of Democrats who basically say Biden is the only person who could conceivably be trusted in to block Trump. In fact, Ignatius is saying he is someone who could lose to him. And as he writes, time is running out. So what do you think of this? Does it actually represent a vibe shift on the part of the Democratic Party and, you know, its, you know, leading lights within the media? Or is this something that is designed to just be, you know, kind of a marker for a relevant journalist who wants to make sure that that is kind of on the record from him before potentially, you know, a loss next November?
I think it's more of the latter.
John, go ahead. Yeah.
You know, I think that, yes, Joe Biden could lose to Donald Trump. You know, anybody could lose to anybody out of, you know, sort of major candidates at this point, because the country is fairly evenly divided and, you know, politics is a fickle thing. I think that sort of the Ignatius wish casting here is, in a world in which Joe Biden had basically sort of made clear he was going to be a one-term president, or, you know, that we're having this conversation even at the beginning of this year, I think it looks a little bit different. I think what Biden does right now is he is a vehicle for papering over the differences that exist within the Democratic Party circa 2023. He may not be anybody's favorite, but they're all okay with him. And he is somebody that can sort of stave off a potential civil war. I mean, if you have, if he were to step aside, you're going to have a messy primary. And granted, it's compressed at this point, but you're going to kind of be vetting people on the fly. I think it opens the door to some oppo hits from Republicans, just because there's only been so much time for, look, we live in a world in which Ed Gillespie, you know, one of the most talented political guys of his generation, missed the Ralph Northam blackface stuff.
Yeah.
Where the Democrats missed George Santos pretty much making up his entire life story. And you're talking about in just a period of months where you have these candidates, you know, again, even if you're at the state level, it's a different thing when you're trying to get onto that national stage. And to try to replace the guy that kind of holds everything together, whatever his shortcomings as a candidate and whatever the ticket shortcomings, the narrative is going to shift to, you know, Democrats in disarray instead of the narrative being completely about Donald Trump. So why take that off the board if you're them for something where the outcome is uncertain? Where you're going to have the factional elements, whether it's along identity or ideology or what have you, especially when Joe Biden can say, look, I'm 1-0 against Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's no real challenger in the party right now. To me, I think he is sort of the transitional Pope kind of thing for Democrats that, he's four more years and he is off the stage. It's not like, you know, Barack Obama, who's still kind of hanging around at the periphery. Like, Biden is done. So and no one, and we've talked about this before, I don't think anyone wants to be the guy that fires first to say, like, hey, Joe's got, out of a viable candidate, I don't think Gavin Newsom's gonna be like, hey, Joe's got to go. So I think it's probably bad. I think following what Ignatius is saying is probably bad strategy for Democrats, just from a risk standpoint, that I think you minimize your risk while doing what you have, sticking with what you have now, while acknowledging there still are real risks there.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily a vibe shift, but it's one of the things you would see early on if it were a vibe shift. So it's not necessarily one, but it's the kind of stuff that is indicative that we're in the early stages perhaps of something like that. And I mean, we talked too about how Josh Barrow and his Substack made Barrow's kind of a arch, you know, centrist figure in the Substack world, political commentator, and a Biden guy, like an unabashed Biden guy, like actively likes Joe Biden. He's the one guy, right? And you know, thinks he's a good president, supported him in the primary, blah, blah, blah. And he is talking about, he's not off of Biden yet, but he thinks, you know, for similar reasons to Ignatius, that he needs to dump Kamala, and his argument is for Gretchen Whitmer, but you know, we talk about that if we want, but you know, so those
it's
are kind of
well,
early...
but I would just say it's absurd for all the reason that Ben Dreyfuss has been just like killing it for the last 12 hours in terms of an idea.
I don't think you can do that, yeah. but there's a little bit of, and it's also worth saying that the it wouldn't need to be Gavin Newsom or any candidate saying anything. Democrats do this sort of stuff through the press. I mean, look at what they're doing to Dianne Feinstein, right? Like, you know, mm-hmm. they're perfectly happy to just leak Joe Biden to literal death. They'll do it in the public discourse. They don't need any, you know, anybody who wants to, you know, succeed him to actually pull the trigger. But there's a little bit of an analogy to my beloved and like, you know, like tragically doomed New York Jets here, because you know, they
invested, you brought it up, I didn't.
Yeah,
I just
appreciate it. Yeah, they invested, the Democrats invested. I mean, I'm not comparing Joe Biden to Aaron Rodgers in terms of resumes and their.
Well, Aaron Rodgers would obviously both be a better president and obviously
and a better quarterback. Yeah, even
well,
with one,
no. I would not just vote for Aaron Rodgers. I would campaign for him, fundraise for him. Everything that he's done that has insulted the entirety of ESPN for the last like 2 years is something that makes me like him more. So anyway, proceed.
Well, so you know, Biden is a journeyman. You know, Rodgers is a four-time MVP. But in the moment, right, the Democrats said we've got this opportunity to create a very rare thing in American politics, which is a one-term president, and they went with the guy that they thought was the surest bet to do that. And they said, well, what are we going to do about the VP? Well, we'd better give it to a woman of color, somebody who, you know, even though she became a progressive about 15 minutes before she ran for president, somebody who would appeal to the sort of identitarian nature of our faction. And we don't have to worry about her. It's a bone we're throwing, you know, to that part of the coalition, because we've got this very safe, very, you know, journeyman white guy who's going to beat, you know, Donald Trump for us. And so they didn't have to worry about the backup, because, you know, in this analogy, we've got number eight is going to take us to the promised land. I don't have to worry about Zach Wilson. And then what could happen to an 82-year-old guy running for a second term? You know, he could step out on the debate stage and tear his Achilles, you know, four snaps into the debate, right? So it's the same high wire act that they're running. So in a way, both Ignatius and John are correct. I mean, I do think it's right that a guy like a Joe Biden is the guy you need to beat Donald Trump, or at least I think there's as much evidence for that as there is for any other, you know, hypothetical strategy to beat Donald Trump if you're a Democrat. But at the same time, it's a very, very, very high leverage, high risk play, because the guy, as I've said before, is 137 years old and is forgetting where he is half the time. And so, I mean, that about sums it up.
Go to bed. Go to bed. Go to bed. If you don't think that's a chant that he's going to hear, like, I mean, come on. It's very, yeah. You know, this is disastrous. I mean,
and I think John said it last week that Trump is like, what, 5 or 6 years younger than Biden, but he seems like he's 20 years younger than him. And it's, you know, love or hate Trump, I mean, there's going to be a big contrast on that stage.
No, I will. I think you do need to note, though, and I think that's you know, all true. But you know, Trump isn't keeping up the schedule that he kept in 2016,
no.
2015, right? He's 8 years older than he was before, and he's got a mountain of things to worry about that he didn't have before. So I think you can sort of see,
he goes to Iowa. There. Wait, just to support that, he goes to Iowa. He goes to this football game. And I think a lot of us are used to seeing him like parade around with Melania at things like this. And instead, you know, there are banners being flown in the air over the game saying, where's Melania? There are flyers saying, have you seen this woman being passed out around there? And there's just this kind of feeling that like, this is not a unified Trump team. You know, there's not the same kind of skating above it all, you know, avoiding all of the different, you know, sort of things that would bring you down normally. It just feels different. the vibe is different.
Yeah, it's like not the fun third. Anymore. Oh, certainly. Yeah, it's like the third heavyweight match between the same two guys who fought each other in their early 20s, their late 20s, and now they're fighting each other in their mid 30s. And, you know, the question is, who's lost more of a step?
Yeah, John, you just said it's not fun anymore. Elaborate.
Well, I think look, I was never a Trump guy, but I think that there was something kind of Trump broke the fourth wall of American politics. And I think you see it with a lot of these candidates with set piece speeches or with politicians, outside the Capitol that go to the podium. And it is like, kind of like a Mad Libs of rhetoric, right? Where you can sort of scramble, four dozen different phrases and rearrange them in different ways. And it always kind of comes up. And I think Trump part of the Trump magic was just sort of like blowing right past that, saying unsayable things, which I think was again, a lot of the appeal for people. It had I think all these people like, oh, I love Trump's policies. Sure. Everybody likes taxes cut. And newsflash, probably any Republican president would have signed a very similar bill. But it's, I think the style stuff and the just sort of Americans have, I think he got that Americans look at politics as a form of entertainment now. As a guy who always liked the boring Midwestern governor, I have been just disappointed and hurt again and again by the fact that those people just get steamrolled in this. But now there isn't that twinkle in his eye. There isn't that, he's become
I'll take it even further than that. My own detection is desperation. I read in his physical reaction to this whole scenario, I need to win in order to avoid jail time and serious legal consequences for myself. And, maybe I'm misreading that, but that's the way that I read it. Everything that in terms of his activity since, sort of all these cases started to come forward seems to vindicate that, assumption. We'll see. I mean, it's there's a lot still, up in the air regarding those things. But
so along those lines, let me pose this question to you guys. If you're advising Donald Trump, which, I don't envy anybody that, but if his primary objective at this point is basically to use the presidency as a legal shield against these indictments, I mean, do you try to make the case to him that we're better off to have a fresh face run, and you try to get your support for them is conditional on basically a pardon,
right?
Which again, it would be sort of corrupt bargain 2.0. That you would have. I mean that president would be
actually you wouldn't. I just have to interject. You actually wouldn't need a pardon for the federal cases. You would just shut them down.
Which I think would give you create the same problem then of political problem for whoever the new Republican president would be.
Yeah.
And I think particularly in light of all of the Proud Boys, being convicted, I think, it would not look good. But if you're Trump, I mean,
I just say, isn't it a little weird that they gave that guy 22 years when he wasn't even at January 6th? That was kind of a little weird. Just saying.
They overcharged a little bit.
A lot of overcharging going on there and a lot of undercharging going on for the Summer of Love protests, I would just say. Just with the time that we have left, I want to move on a little bit to talk about this situation with Vivek's New Hampshire chairman, I guess, who has shown himself to be both an Israel apartheid kind of guy, but also a 9/11 truther. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you is just, do you think that 9/11 trutherism has grown on the right in the wake of both COVID and the Trump ascendance and battle with the deep state?
I think that it has probably a little. But I think the more relevant dynamic is that there's this broad-based and growing suspicion among right-leaning America about every elite narrative about everything. and we could go through COVID and we could talk about the education system and gender and race and the summer of love that you just brought up. And there's a lot of reasons for it, but you know, the short story is that all of the, you know, the institutions that pretty much to a one that the people who were sort of broadly center right in America used to, you know, ground their allegiance and patriotism in, you know, from the, you know, sort of stodgy network news media to, you know, the FBI to, even, you know, sort of like mainline Protestant religion to, I mean, you go down the list, all of those institutions have been captured by the sort of forces of the cultural left. And I don't think you have to be a conspiratorialist or a Claremont guy to recognize that that's true. And so you've got this longer term trend of suspicion among the right, the people you kind of need to hold down the flag, to wave the flag, to do patriotism, to volunteer and join the military, to do public service, to keep their communities together and clean. And like that whole class has been deeply, deeply cynicized, if I can coin a word, to all these institutions that they used to ground their sort of love of country in because those institutions have been taken over by the left. And the result of that is things like they're just more willing to entertain conspiracy theories about anything. It doesn't have to be 9/11 trutherism. It's really just anything from Q right on down to vaccines, you know, and they have this skepticism about the elite narrative of what, you know,
Mexico has their aliens out today. So, yeah.
So John, I think, yeah.
Yeah. No, John, what do you think about this?
I think it's certainly possible. And I think for all the reasons, I think Dan did a really good job outlining, but I think it also kind of goes back to, well, we are in this era of enormous negative, you know, partisanship or, you know, reaction to the other party. You've also got this like kind of weird, you know, Ouroboros of basically conspiracy theorists on both sides kind of holding hands now on stuff, or, you know, that you have basically the far right and the far left that both seem to agree that like America is not that great, or that there's, you know, that our institutions are rotten. And look, there's, I think that there's plenty of institutional rot to go around. And I think that a lot of our institutions have not necessarily covered themselves in glory in the last 25 or 30 years. That said, you know, it's a lot easier to tear down than it is to build. And what's going to fill this vacuum? I think that the only way out of the time that we're in of I think a lot of turmoil and chaos, and I think it's, you know, economic as much as it is, you know, social and cultural, is to basically rally around you know, an idea of America as a open pluralistic society, but one that still that is grounded in its own history and tradition that's open to everybody, right? The more perfect union. And the more that we say that the fruits of that union, you know, of the, you know, 250 almost years of it are bad and broken, you know, whether it's, you know, because they're systemically racist or because they're, you know, progressive and, you know, anti, you know, whatever it is on the right, I think that those are both just a solvent to the glue that keeps things from really spinning off the rails. And I think it's really dangerous. I think the stuff with Ramaswamy, I don't think that anything seems to be disqualifying anymore, but I mean, come on, like, you know, if you quack like a duck and you walk like a duck, I mean, at what point can we just say, like, it's not even like, haha, that, you know, Vivek is a 9/11 truther. And, you know, he may not be, but the fact it's almost worse. It's almost worse that he will say this stuff. He will associate with these guys. And, you know, I'm sure it's just to get the clicks. I mean, you know,
I'm going to say something that will probably get me in trouble, but Vivek seems to me to be the kind of person who, if I had a conversation about Israel in a bar, it would not end well. And by that, I mean, I outweigh Vivek by probably 100 pounds, and I'm at least 5 inches, maybe 6 inches taller than him. He seems to me like the kind of person that if I ran into in a bar, without kind of the context of like he's a political person running for office, there would be words, because the idea that he would maintain or pussyfoot around Israel playing some kind of role in 9/11 or the idea that like Jews would be escaping from it. Like that's literally the thing that his New Hampshire person who he's defended, you know, was maintaining on Twitter. Like that's not, we don't know the full story about the Saudi involvement. You know, there's a big difference there, dude. You cannot go down the road of like, well, there weren't that many Jews inside of the World Trade Center. Like that is not something we can bandy about and have any kind of conversation with that person. You know,
yeah.
And
well, so there's one other thing that I haven't seen mentioned, which is, you guys remember that Onion headline from a few years ago? It was like Sergeant explains 9/11 to Marine in Afghanistan, right? Or something like that. It was from a few years ago, you know, before the ignominious pullout. But that's a dynamic here that I think matters. A lot of people, a lot of energy on the right is people under 30.
Yep.
You know, or around that age.
They have no recollection of it.
They have no idea.
No context. Yeah.
I mean, I was a senior in high school. You guys were around the same age. I saw the plume on the skyline from the hilltop behind my school, you know, but I remember talking to a great, like really talented NR intern, whatever, 10 years ago about on this day. And he was like, yeah, well, the fifth graders were allowed to watch TV, but the rest of us fourth graders weren't, you know? And so even there, I was like just struck by the generational difference.
I don't think I'm breaking any kind of confidence to say that when, you know, I was on Fox on 9/11 and with Brett and he said to me, you know, his sons do not recall it at all. They were both alive, but they don't recall it.
Yeah. So that's a dynamic. I mean, I don't think it has the weight with, you know, alt-right, but with like Alex Stein doesn't, you know, and the people who watch that show, they don't, you know, they don't have the same kind of direct visceral memories of that era that a lot of us older folks do. And I think that's part of this.
Look, I think the way that I would just put it is this, there's a need for the Republican Party to have some kind of internal policing of itself, but that has not been apparent for a very long time. And the demands of the DC, you know, sort of partisan media is, you know, you will respond to this by denouncing that person, but that doesn't actually work because people don't have any more faith in you than they do in the person you're denouncing. So from my perspective, right, I just don't know what the solution is. I don't know how to recommend to people that like, this is the way you deal with folks who dabble in this kind of conspiracy theorizing. And, you know, unfortunately, I just think it's a problem that we're going to have to deal with and work through for the next couple of decades, because I just don't know a solution, an outside solution that, you know, restores the equivalent of, you know, smoke-filled rooms.
I don't think you can. And what I'm going to propose, I think, is something that you also can't do. But it is time to decentralize a lot of the levers of governance. You know, make it so it doesn't matter as much if you have people with extremely exotic or evil views. In the case of people that the sort of 9/11 truther community, you know, make sure that they, you know, that they, there's this thing you always see that, you know, Republicans will criticize, or, you know, Democrats too, will criticize, you know, oh, there's this government program or these powers that are the executive branch and they're awful and we need to get rid of them. Oh, except when we're in charge and now we can, you know, use those levers of power to meet our own ends. I think for things that aren't essential functions, I think that the more you can break that apart and, you know, fracture it and localize it, you know, it means that the damage that any one person or any group of people can do becomes far less. I think we need to have a real embrace of localism and the local governance.
You're speaking my language, man. I love
it. And I think it's de-escalatory. And I think we need an enormous amount of de-escalation in our politics. And the less that, and I get it. I mean, I am not of the, you know, I'm much more, you know, pro-life than not in my orientation, but I get it. If you are, you know, for some of the people in the pro-choice world that, you know, again, no, I mean, I think that the court actually did sort of you know, return thing. They did return things back locally, but you know, when you hear somebody like Lindsey Graham talking about national legislation, right, the ability to be able to do that does, you know, where those decisions then would be sort of taken away. The ability to invest that kind of power in a central way, I think every election does seem like life and death then. And we need to move away from that. It needs to be, you know, sort of like the Avid Brothers song where, you know, your life doesn't change by the guy that's elected. And every election shouldn't be the most important one of our lifetimes, but that's not going to, it's not going to change anytime soon.
Dan, wrap us up.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to it's the $1 million question. You need to make politics boring. You need to reestablish a kind of disinterest, you know, a salutary neglect from a certain, you know, segment of the American public. Unfortunately, I think it's like what tends to do that and what tends to usher in eras like that are like, you know, once in a generation, if that cataclysmic events, you know, and or once in a generation peace and prosperity after cataclysmic events. I mean, sort of the golden age everybody talks about in American political life is the kind of consensus, you know, there's the era of good feelings, right? The early Republic, and then there's the post-World War II consensus. I mean, that papers over a lot of real differences that happened, you know, that were existing in American politics then. But that was a combination of the entire rest of the world burnt to the ground, down to the cinders, and we became the global hegemon and had a 25-year period of unbroken prosperity. And things were kind of chill for a little while. And, you know, it tends to be those sort of cleansing fires, you know, things get worse before they get better. And one of the first slogans about the sort of post-2016 era in American politics that I think gets it right is the only way out is through. And we're just going to have to wrestle this bear, this cocaine bear, until we figure out a new consensus. And I don't think anyone knows what it's going to look like.
Breaking moves. breaking moves. Vivek Ramaswamy tweets, had dinner with Jake Paul on Sunday. He changed my mind, convinced me to join TikTok. Yes, kids under age 16 shouldn't be using it, but fact is that many young voters are. We're not going to be changing this country without winning. Can't just talk about the importance of the GOP reaching young voters while hiding in our own echo chambers. It's bad when the CCP collects data from U.S. users, but the truth is it's no better when American companies like Airbnb do the same thing.
The full Amari. Now, the question, Ben, is if Jake Paul is with Ramaswamy when you run into him at that bar.
You know, it's a slip there, but yes, they are the same person on some level. Except I think that Vivek is a good dad. I'll leave that in this podcast. So, but proceed.
If Jake Paul's there, do you still, you know, throw down? Do you still throw down the gauntlet? That's the real question.
That's a good question. I think you have to, because if you get beat up, you can at least say, I was defending America. And that, and that just like if you get beat up defending America, like then it's rocky territory, you know. It's like actually like I can you know take this, you know, I can run with this. Look, I've been very public about this. I just think that this guy is a complete awful monster within the Republican sphere. I think that the fact that he's been promoted by the people who have promoted him is very telling. Including, you know, the you know people who were so emphatic about Evan McMullen and everything like that in the past, and I just think I think he's bland. I think that this is not real, and I'll be very curious to see what ends up, because I think that there's some possibility that he ends up, you know, announcing to the world that the best president of all time and you know from here forth and for all. Forever is Donald Trump, and that he will drop out to run for Ohio Senate or something like that, which is what his original plan was. But we have to see. Apparently he's on TikTok now, which is no worse than Airbnb. You heard it here first, folks. This has been Thunderdome. Thank you so much for listening to us. For Dan, for John, I'm Ben Dominich, and I encourage you to go to thespectator.com to subscribe to our newsletters, our podcasts, and to our magazine. It's an excellent product, and we will be back next week to talk all the more about this crazy 2024 election. Thank you for listening.